Wow, that was a lot of really good stuff from James Myrtle. We'd once again like to thank him for coming on. We'll now turn to Corey Pronman to discuss scouting and the draft.
So now we'll turn our attention to the draft and bring in Corey Pronman from Hockey Prospectus and ESPN to discuss his ranking of prospects and how he sees the draft going in these early days. Welcome, Corey.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Okay, so the first question, I'd actually like to get from you your general methodology, how you approach this, how you look at these prospects and rank them.
Okay, sure. The process I use when it comes to my evaluation of prospects when I rank them is not like the one of an independent scouting service like you see other way and other places on the internet or in terms of offerings like Redline Report and international scouting services. Because I'm one person, I don't really approach it the same method as they do, where they send a team out and go off by just their own reports. It's because, like I said, I am one person. So what I do is I rely a lot on talking to scouts and NHL executives within the industry. I get a lot of reports and information from them. I do see players myself, and just because, again, I'm one person, so I definitely rely a lot on video work. So I definitely do like to watch kids, but I also talk to a lot of other scouts just to kind of get as much information as I can about these players. Then I'll take all the information that I have put together and then independently assess the value of that information.
So it seems like with prospects, you can't rely on stats as much. You basically have to go with more eye tests.
Stats, I think, can bring you to a certain level, but they can only go so far. At Hockey Prospectus, one of our columns and Ian Fife has kind of shown that there is definitely predictive value for using stats. But you also have to go beyond just looking at the box scores. You got to adjust for things like what's their age, their birth date, the league they play in, their team strength, all the other things. And you can get some predictive value and you can kind of bring some context into the picture. But as you guys have all seen from analyzing NHL, there's so much context that is missing from your basic golden points. So if someone were to tell you player A was better than player B because he scored more points at the NHL level, you guys would probably throw out a bunch of stuff from behind the net or whatnot and just basically show them how wrong they are. And that's the same argument that you use at the junior level. If one guy has more points than the other guy, that doesn't necessarily mean he's a better player. There's a lot of context missing, be it luck, usage, competition, team strength. There's a whole bunch of factors. So like I will look at stats. I would say I use that as a secondary measure in my evaluation process. And I definitely have it in the back of my mind, but I definitely do not use it as the primary means for ranking and evaluating prospects.
Okay, and the stats we like to look at are sort of possession metrics. You got, you know, Fenwick, Corsi, that sort of thing. Obviously, those really are not available at all for these junior guys. So in terms of evaluating who is sort of good at possession-oriented game, what are the things you look at when you're watching a player to see who could excel at that at the NHL level?
You're talking about from a stats perspective or you're talking about from a scouting perspective?
Scouting perspective. How do you sort of scout for guys that are going to be good at the possession game?
That's the kind of thing where it gets kind of a gray area right there, because I've talked to a lot of teams that do – we emphasize possession ability in their scouting, and I would ask them, okay, so this is what you guys like. How do you find it? What does a possession player look like? And I would say I get a general consensus back, but it's not universal. There's definitely some teams that will describe possession ability in several different forms. From teams that I've talked to, from people I would say I trust more, and from me watching my based on my own hockey knowledge, I would say puck skills, hockey sense, puck moving skills, those are the core, that's the core possession ability in my opinion. The ability to make plays, to move the puck, to hold on to it, and to distribute around to your teammates. Those are the key things I look for. I think for forwards, being able to transition the puck up the ice is a little more important. So you look at skating ability. For defensemen, being able to separate the puck off forwards, such as a physical game, makes them a little more important for them. And those, I think, are the key attributes I look for when looking for quote-unquote possession skills.
Great. And One of the things I was reading your introduction on how you rate guys, and you talked about rating defensemen differently than forwards. How do you separate those two?
At this point right now, I think most of the hockey community is aware of the risk on drafting goalies. Everybody's aware that it's really hard to do. There's a lot of risk on that. Most of the top goalies in the NHL come from a late-round pick just because the development risk is just so high and so much uncertainty. And I think we've kind of established that. Defensemen, I think we're just starting to get there right now. But like I said, before I went into this, I think we looked at I talked to a bunch of smart people who run the numbers and kind of took an assessment that defensemen tend to have a little more development risk than forwards do. The difference between, I would say, forward and between the defensive risk and the goalie risk is goalies tend to be very persistent on a year-to-year basis in the NHL. Your resident winner 1 year is your backup the next year sometimes, Brian Elliott. But for defensemen, that doesn't always seem to be the case. So there definitely is a lot of value in hitting on a top pair defenseman, for example. But there's just, it's really hard to, not really hard, but harder than it is forward to identify top talent in the draft. So again, this is kind of something I think this view is going to progress as the years go on, as I get more data and just kind of get a better feel on exactly how valuable defensemen should be in the draft. But the stance I took going into these rankings were, if the call is anywhere close between a forward and a D, I'm going forward. If there's a clear drop off a forward between a D and a forward, I'm taking a defenseman. And I think that kind of balanced out the draft risk, but also acknowledging that good defensemen still have a lot of value in the NHL.
So take a more cautious approach overall.
Exactly.
Okay. I guess Brent had a couple questions about more on scouting and what you like to watch. Brent?
I was curious what sort of environments do you get a chance to watch? I don't know that much about it. Have you gotten a chance to watch say for example Swedish players in men's leagues? How much junior hockey do you get a chance to watch, and how much do you, how highly do you rate the world championships and the under 18 tournaments when talking about prospects?
The world championships or the world juniors?
The world juniors. I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay, I figured that's what you were talking about. I just wanted to make sure. Let's see. So this year, I mean, I've watched like hundreds of games, so I'm trying to think of what I watch more. I mean, all major tournaments I definitely keep my eye on. So all the major international events, the pre-World Junior camps I watch a lot. I'm a U.S.-based guy, so I watch a ton of college hockey. I probably watch about 3 to 4 college hockey games a weekend. Junior hockey I don't watch as much, like I said, because I'm U.S.-based, and I definitely outsource a lot. But I do watch a lot of videos for junior hockey. I'd probably say at least one game. Try to average about one game a week, but it's not always easy to do. The major tournaments, like I said, the under-18s and world juniors, I basically watch every game of those tournaments. In terms of the Finnish and Swedish men's league, I don't really get to watch those players. That's kind of why I rely on the international events. And from talking to scouts who I know overseas, they kind of relay that information to me. I can catch a little bit of KHL hockey here and there. I mean, I watch a little bit of watching the USHL as well, and that pretty much does it on that front in terms of what I see. In terms of what your question on the tournaments, those tournaments, I think, and there's definitely people in the industry who think this way, but also there'll be a couple who don't, but in terms of those tournaments, I approach them in the light that I do not really care much about performance in those tournaments. What I'm looking for in those tournaments is to see a guy who I have not seen in a long time and kind of get a basic feel for him. If I have not seen a player in like 3 months or maybe a year or something like that, I'm going to go into the World Juniors and take a look at, okay, what does his body look like? How does his skating look? What are some basic things that I can take from his performance that I can say with some surety that those are things are true? But I'm not going to obviously take a guy who has a good tournament and draw a conclusion about him. And that's because obviously that's not sensible. But those tournaments have value because they are a mass viewing opportunity. The chance to see a ton of good prospects all at one place. And that's how I approach it, to get a basic feel of a large amount of prospects in a short amount of time.
Right, okay. That's kind of the sense that I had, is that I think people tend to confuse a very exciting ability to see all these guys in one place and then to hype players who have very good tournaments who may not necessarily have a great NHL career ahead of them. So, yeah, that sounds like you get to see quite a lot.
This is actually a question Brent asked me earlier, brought up earlier to me off air, but is there any kind of groundswell for more stats or these things to be recorded at the junior level? Because a lot of the time they don't even track time on ice or anything other than goals and assists.
Everybody wants more information. Who are you going to go pay to track it? That's the question that's being asked at the AHL level and at the junior level. Teams want more information. Teams want time on ice info. And that's just the basic. I mean, that is essentially basic information. But you got to have somebody in the rink every game tracking it, and you got to pay them to do that. And who's paying for it?
Right. I mean, maybe NHL teams, but they probably already, they probably already have scouts who get a sense of what the ice time is. But you don't need to know exactly how many minutes a guy is playing. You know, if the scout sees him play 25 minutes, you know, he's going to know what kind of roles he fills for that team.
Right. And when I talk to scouts or talk to fellow junior hockey, they generally have a good sense of this guy's logging ridiculous amount of minutes, this guy's not playing much, this guy's not on the fourth line. You can get a sense of that as you watch these guys play. What the time on ice would help do is to kind of know about those guys who you don't watch a lot. Or it would help the fans, and it would help just like the team that plays in Baie-Comeau that nobody watches in the Quebec League. And you really want to get a sense of how these players are being used. That would help, I think. Well, the Quebec League has it. I think having shots and shooting percentage in the OHL and WHL would help a lot. We have it in the AHL now, and it helps a tremendous amount for identifying, well, not for me, not for the NHL teams, but for me personally, to identify, you know, shooting luck. And that would probably be the next step for us to have, and I think we need that a little more time on ice. But I don't see that happening imminently, but I think once the AHL starts recording more sophisticated stats, I think that'll start trickling down afterwards to the junior level.
Okay, and then actually our own Corey had a question about comparing stats from different areas. Corey?
I just wanted to get your thoughts on NHL equivalencies from Gabe's Behind the Net site. Basically, he takes like the goal and points per game totals from players from a certain league and compares them to how they did once they jumped to the NHL. And like, he has a different translation factor for them. Like a player that goes from the AHL to the NHL is expected to keep about 44% of their scoring. And he uses that as a way to predict how they'll do in the NHL. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that system.
Sure thing. I'm quite familiar with that. Actually, a hockey perspective, Raul Bowman is kind of like taking what he did before, what Gabe did, and kind of went a step further. He updated them recently in turn because Gabe was from quite a few years ago. Volman updated them. He showed at the AHL level the separation between different ages, how the translation factors differed. And it's good stuff. I like the work, but what I think it does is not good, in my opinion, to use on an individual player because it's very deprived of sample. I like it when you use it on the grand scale to identify league strength because you get a large sample of games and you can feel very confident that we are truly getting towards what a league strength is relative to other leagues. But when you use it on one player, it gets at the same argument is, would you use 1 year of points to identify talent level at the NHL level? And if you say no to that, then how can you use it at a different league level? I think you'll get close to what a player is, but there's so much context missing that you don't know if the player you're translating in year one was really lucky or really unlucky, or there was some sort of usage context that you're not really getting, and it really doesn't capture as much information as you want. So I'll look at it, I'll take it, you know, for face value, but I really just think NHL equivalencies are better being used at the league level rather than at the individual level.
Now let's turn to this year's draft. Obviously, Edmonton won the lottery, and so they will pick first. They're really stacked with young forwards. Do you see them trading or possibly drafting a defenseman with Yakupov, obviously, is the number one prospect on your list and most people's?
Well, here's my sense for Edmonton. if they're going to keep the pick has to be Yakupov, in my opinion. I mean, you can ask whoever you want. In my opinion, based on a couple of scouts I've talked to, there is a clear, distinct difference between him and a guy like Ryan Murray, who seems to be the consensus name that everyone thinks he's going to pick. Edmonton would pick if they were to take a defenseman. But here's the thing. If they want a defenseman, it can't be through the draft. That's my stance on it. Let's just play it out. Let's just say they trade the first overall for a high second, and they get Ryan Murray with the second or third overall pick. We'll just play that out. Ryan Murray gets drafted. Let's just say he's in the NHL next year, which is not 100%. He's most NHL-ready D-man, but it's not 100%. He's in the NHL. Let's just pretend he gets to the NHL. You guys are all smart. You know how rookie defensemen are used. What is Ryan Murray in his first year?
A back pairing defenseman, probably, with, you know, you could sign a guy like that for, you know, $1 million and play him back there, you know. I can't imagine a strong player coming in for his first year.
And that's to be, he's even 19 years old. Let's go 1 year further. He's 20. You know, being fair, what is a 20-year-old defenseman going to be in the NHL?
I mean, there have been guys who've had great year 20 seasons, Doughty, Petrangelo, I think. But, yeah, I mean, more likely than not, he won't even be a second-pairing defenseman probably in his second year. Maybe he'll get second-pairing time due to injury, but again, you're throwing a defenseman to the Wolves. I'm a Devils fan. I watched Adam Larson this year, and Larson was very impressive at times, but also he was completely lost sometimes. He's rated as a much stronger prospect than Ryan Murray is. At least that's my perception.
Yeah, you'd be correct on the Larson. I would agree with that. Now, with that information in mind, because we played Ryan Murray 2 years out, we can agree whether or not we did it right or not. Eugene Hopkins' contract is up. Hall's is already up. Eberle's is already up. Pajarvi's is up. Gagne, who knows what happens to him. What does this team look like in 2 years from now? From a performance standpoint and from a contract standpoint, and who knows if any of those young players are still there, and Ryan Murray might be a below-average second-pairing defenseman by then. So what did that do the team any good by picking Ryan Murray? Did it change the complexion of this team that desperately needed defensemen in any significant form?
Yeah, I mean, no, and I think, I've heard trade scenarios bandied about, like, Phoenix possibly trading Oliver Ekman-Larsson for the second overall pick. I mean, these are more hypotheticals than anything else. But I wonder, do you think there might be a fit with Edmonton trading the first overall for an established NHL defenseman?
It depends who you talk to. I think the two teams that I think have the best fit would be Nashville and Phoenix. They're both teams that kind of lack scoring, you know, Radulov aside. And they're both teams that have an excellent young defenseman, either in the NHL or coming up through their system. I think those are the two ideal trade partners. I think Ekman-Larsson is an ideal person you get, but I mean, that guy's a really hard guy to pry away. You're talking about a guy who's an established top defenseman on a team that's headed to the conference finals. Yeah, and Yakupov could be a tremendous player, but Ekman-Larsson already is a tremendous player. So I think if you're going to go to Phoenix, you most likely would be talking about Rundblad more or less than you would be talking about Ekman-Larsson. But like I said, just getting back to the whole issue about taking, it's basically, my point I was trying to make is if you draft a defenseman, on average, and again, like you mentioned, there are players like Dowdy, Victor Lange, who stepped in right away and were studs right from the get-go. On average, you're waiting until, you know, that those D-men's early 20s before they become significant players. And based on the makeup of this roster and how these second contracts are going to come into play, again, not knowing how the new CBA plays out, I don't think Edmonton can truly wait for that set defenseman for another 4 years. I love Klefbom, but I don't think he's a number one D-man, and I don't see where that player is coming from in that system. Even if they draft him, I don't think he's going to get there in time before some of those top forwards might potentially be leaving the team.
Right, no, absolutely. I think Edmonton hasn't shown themselves to really understand how these entry-level contract things work, so they might end up doing what you're saying they absolutely should not do, which is to put Ryan Murray in the NHL next year. The good news for them is I think they have six defensemen under contract already, so they might They might be willing to send Ryan Murray, or if they trade down and they do take a defenseman, they might be willing to let him breathe a bit in the junior leagues.
Chase, did you have a comment there?
No, I think they pretty much covered it. I had a question though, just as far as the overall rankings. From everything I and I guess a lot of other people have been hearing, this draft is really kind of weak with top end talent, and that kind of goes along to some of the stuff you've said. I was looking at your rankings, like, where do you see the real cutoff between, like, you know, a solid, just like a solid regular NHL player and, like, a guy who can really step in and make a difference as a top six forward or maybe a top four D in a few years? Like, where's the drop-off going to be as far as the draft order?
You just said a couple of things there, so I'll touch them point by point. I know some scouts I talk to believe this is a weak draft. I've talked to some who don't, though, and I personally I share that belief as well. I think this draft has more risk than usual at the top. I think Galchenyuk and Riley present a lot of risk. I think Dumba, as a small D-man, is going to kind of worry some people, so there's some risk there. Grigorenko has established some red flags in the community, so there's risk. But I think on an overall talent level, the top of the draft and the depth throughout is fine, in my opinion. I really don't see it being weak on a pure talent level. I just think also because there's more D-men in the first round, there's just more risk there as well. So that's kind of just touching on that point right there. In terms of the drop-off, I'm a very big proponent of Mikhail Grigorenko. I've seen him kind of still the top tier with Neil Yakupov. Obviously, I rank him below him, but I think very highly of him. I think Galchenyuk kind of got a tier below that. After Ryan Murray, I said there was another drop-off in talent. Then after Zengis Girgensen, I said there's another drop-off. In terms of your question of who can be a top six forward or top four defenseman, I mean, arguably there's a bunch of players throughout the draft who I can say arguably has some of the components that they could be that player. It's really when it comes to this, usually when you want to get past the first 20 picks, it usually becomes a marginal difference between players. If you ever look at like what a draft distribution looks like in terms of games played, you'll see that very slow day decline once you get to around 15 or 20. And I will look at these players and I say, I think he could be a top six forward, I think he could be a top four D-man if this improves or if his development goes well in terms of this aspect or whatnot. And I know it's not really a great answer to your question, but I would say it's like kind of like, there's no, I would say the top six, top four talent ends around 60 to 70. But knowing realistically that there's not that many top six, four, top four defensemen in the draft, I think there's that many guys who probably have a chance to be that.
And how many would you say are likely to be?
It's
kind of a, I know it's a rough word to give you, but.
Yeah, okay, so you said top six, top four?
Sure.
All right, let me go look at my rankings again. Just give me a second. Off the top of my head, I would say, I would say my top 20 to 24 players, I say, have that kind of talent level. Which is, I mean, that's roughly, at least to the best of my knowledge, and I might be way off on that, roughly how many players that kind of talent level kind of addressed. Although I obviously know that's not gonna happen to me, but I say it is, because shit happens, and that players don't develop like you say they are. But I would say roughly around 20, 24 players I like in terms of being, I think, likely the strong word, but I would say much more confident than the rest of the pack. I think they have the ability to reach that kind of potential.
So, like, we did some trade deadline podcasts, and one of the teams we talked a little in-depth about was Nashville. They traded a first-round pick to get Paul Gostad, and we figured that, or at least I did, I can't speak for what anybody else said, that they might be okay because the bottom end of the first round was kind of looking a little scarce. So if you were advising them in that situation, how would you, like, what would you have told them on a move like that? I mean, obviously you're saying like around 24 has the possibility to get them some real value. So would you would have probably advised against something like that, I'm guessing?
Well, I mean, Paul, I'm not going to talk about the Paul Gostad here the first, because that's a whole other debate. But in terms of the value of a first-round pick, like I said, I think there's not that much talent in there to become top six, top four defensemen. But the thing with, when you're looking at top 24, is there is much more defensive on average than there usually are in that kind of talent range. So there's no, that that devalues, in my opinion, how much a first round pick is worth. Is worth just because you will likely be picking a defenseman more often than not than you would be in past years in that part of the draft. So I think there's a little less value because there's more risk, not necessarily because the talent level is worse. So it really depends on how much a team approaches drafting defensemen. It would go along how I would advise them, but you guys obviously know my stance on the based on what we just talked about right now. So yes, I would say a first round pick has slightly less value than normal in the middle late of the first round.
Okay, getting back to this draft, we talked about some sort of hypothetical trades for Edmonton. Do you see many trades, if any, near the top this year?
I have not heard anybody say that it's going to be trades halfway, just before anybody goes and writes anything about that. But I do feel by looking at the top of the draft, I feel that there's so many variables that I think it will provoke at least one move at the top. Because like I said, Grigorenko has had a lot of published red flags about him. I know there are definitely a lot of teams that are concerned about him. And if you really are worried about taking a Russian in the top five, before we get into the Yakupov thing, because Grigorenko seems to have more quote-unquote Russian factor things attached to him for whatever reason, they might avoid taking him. I got Chenyuk missed the entire year. And I love his skill set. I know a lot of people who do love him, possibly even love him in the top three. But Angel Esposito was supposed to be a top five prospect guaranteed going into his draft season based on his pre-draft year. Same thing with John McFarland going into the Taylor Hall draft. He was considered a definite top five player. Everybody thought that before the draft season started. We really don't have that extra information about Alex Galchenyuk. We don't have his full year of information to know would he have stepped back. And I know there's definitely going to be some teams who are going to say, you know, he's played three games all year. I'm not even going to bother with that. And there'll be another team who really likes him and might potentially want to trade up and get him. And you'll see there's Morgan Riley. And like I said, there's some question marks on that Dumbo 4 as well. So I think just based on the uncertainty of a lot of top prospects, there's at least the opening and the hypothetical scenarios where you could see some movement going on at the top.
All right, well, it figures to be a pretty exciting or pretty interesting draft day. Okay, I guess we'll leave it there. Perhaps we can have you on again as we get closer to the draft. That's Corey Pronman, again, from ESPN and Hockey Prospectus. You can find him on Twitter, at Corey Pronman. Thanks for joining us.
No problem, guys. Have a good night.
All right,
you too.
All right, so great stuff there from Corey Pronman. Unfortunately, we did have some audio quality issues, which I think we have resolved for the future. So once again, we'd like to thank our guests, James Myrtle from the Globe and Mail and Corey Pronman from ESPN and Hockey Prospectus. Again, you can follow James Myrtle on Twitter at Myrtle and Corey Pronman at Corey Pronman. And your regular NHL Numbers podcast team will be Corey from Shutdown Line and Brent, Chase, and Matt, as well as me, Jared, from Driving Play. We'll be doing a podcast preview of the conference finals here coming up in a couple of days, so we'll look for that. Until then, thanks for listening.